I am tickled to be back in this environment. I'm always pleased to return to Canada after having made an excursion into the United States on various speaking engagements, which is what I have done latterly, speaking in places as disparate as Boise, Idaho, and San Antonio, Texas, to remarkably large gatherings of pre-Paleolithic Neanderthals. And it does my heart good to be back home. Mind you, I have to admit that it does feed my incipient egomania to speak in the United States, because in the United States, unlike Canada, I'm almost always introduced as Ambassador Lewis. And I love that. I treasure it. And I think rather sadly that in Canada, when you have finished your diplomatic tenure, you lose your title and you revert to mortal obscurity again. It's only in the United States. Once an ambassador, always an ambassador. Once a governor, always a governor. Once a president, always a president. The entire country is sustained by titular self-aggrandizement. And Canadians look upon it with a certain bemused affection. I puzzled as I approached this engagement to think of an appropriate context, a context which for me would inevitably be rooted in my own work within the United Nations family. And of course, there is always a natural instinct when pondering multilateralism and the United Nations and international affairs to think in terms of Afghanistan, or Iraq, or indeed what is now happening in Iran, or the election of Hamas, or indeed the rampaging responses to the cartoons which appeared in the Danish newspapers. There is always a tendency to fix one's eyes upon the areas of peace and security. But as I was saying when I had a very privileged conversation earlier this morning with a number of students at the Center for International Affairs here on the campus, for me, the focus and centerpiece of multilateral activities has never been international peace and security, imperative though that may be. It has always been in the area of humanitarian intervention. It has always been in the areas which speak to the tremendous disparities and inequities between the developed and the developing world. And therefore, my mind went back, to some extent logically, to the Millennium General Assembly of the year 2000, when the entire world together etched the Millennium Development Goals, the target for which is the year 2015. And I remember very well the dynamic of that session, because it was actually quite fascinating. The original intention when the 2000 General Assembly was set was to applaud and appreciate the phenomenon of globalization and the assumption that had been made in the late 1990s that globalization would usher in an era of international social equity, greater measures of social justice and harmony, an obvious degree of cultural understanding. And it was indeed perplexing to a great many people when globalization didn't usher in that kind of era at all. Indeed, when globalization showed itself to be fraught with disability, it didn't appear to be able to deal with poverty or with conflict or with disease or with the environment. And it was precisely for those reasons that the world decided to set on a group of goals for 2015 to compensate for what globalization clearly wasn't able to do. Indeed, I remember Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, taking the podium of the General Assembly and saying rather mournfully that globalization had failed to achieve the expectations and that therefore all of the countries there assembled would agree on a different and new set of goals to correct the international social injustice. And so the world did. Every single country, not a single dissenting voice. No one held a gun to the head of any country. And it's worth reminding ourselves of what those 8 millennium goals are, because they speak to the substance of what I subsequently want to reconnoiter. Number 1, to reduce the most egregious and extreme levels of hunger and poverty by half. Number two, to reduce dramatically infant mortality rates. Number three, to reduce dramatically maternal mortality rates. I think I should say at this point that with a kind of demonic, repetitive reality, we have lost over 500,000 women in childbirth every year for the last 20 years, and we've never been able to reduce the number. We know everything there is to know about emergency obstetric intervention. We know about midwives. We know about birth attendants. We know about moving women from rural villages to medical centers when they're in trouble in labor. And we've never been able to reduce the carnage. And therefore, it was obvious that the world would include reductions in maternal mortality as part of the objective for 2015. Number four, that we would put every child of primary school going age into school. There are over 100 million children of primary school going age who are not in school, 60% of them girls. Number five, that we would try to approximate some kind of gender equality, because gender inequality is doing incomparable damage to women right across the planet. Number six, that we would try to turn back the pandemics of AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Number seven, we would attempt to reach a certain environmental sustainability, of which President Piper's recitation of inspiration and aspiration is a part in the local circumstance to reflect the broader global priority. And number eight, we would attempt to fashion a partnership between the developed and the developing world, such that the developed world would finally deliver on its promises rather than betraying them at every turn. And everyone was excited about what had been resolved. And every country left the United Nations General Assembly of the year 2000 determined somehow to work towards the Millennium Development Goals. 5 years later, in that cycle to which the United Nations is addicted of five-year reviews, everybody got together to see what was happening. And sure enough, in places like South Asia, pockets of Southeast Asia and Latin America, and virtually for the entire continent of Africa, the goals will not be reached. And the goals are being confounded by three realities. Number one, poverty. Number two, conflict. And number three, the pandemic of HIV and AIDS. And I want to address those goals in the context of, and those realities in the context of the continent to which I have a particular adherence, the continent of Africa, because it's the continent I know best. And I'm going to bolderize these remarks in order to complete them in the time allotted and in order to be able to engage in a question and answer here and with our colleagues in the interior of British Columbia. Number one is the excruciating reality of poverty. There are simply no words to convey to any North American audience the ferocious assault on the human condition represented by living on less than a dollar a day, which is the destiny of 1,300,000,000 people on the planet, and living on less than $750 a year, which is the destiny of more than 3 billion people on the planet. And if I may be simplistic, but I think accurate, the only way to overcome the eviscerating poverty to which such huge numbers of people on the earth are forced is to provide from the Western world the target of 0.7% of gross national product, which was negotiated by our own Lester Pearson back in 1969, and to which every single major power has subsequently subscribed, and no one has met. No one has even approximated the 0.7. Not a single one of the G8 countries. Now, it's interesting to note that Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Holland, Luxembourg, all these countries are turning over more than 0.7 to their foreign aid budgets, and their economies remain robust, and their economic and financial functioning is not in any way impaired. But for whatever complex of reasons, the Western countries that are dominant, the G7 countries excluding Russia, are the countries that simply refuse to meet the 0.7% target, even though they have promised it time and time again. Now, under the present circumstances, the United Kingdom at the famous G8 conference in Gleneagles last July in Scotland said that it would reach the target by 2012. France said it would reach it by 2013. Germany and Italy said they would reach it by 2015, coincident with the Millennium Development Goals. The United States and Japan will not reach it because they've never embraced the target. At least they are consistent in their perfidy. But Canada, which was the author of the target, has until now absolutely refused to establish a timetable to reach it, which brands us, frankly, as hypocrites in the eyes of the international community and profoundly sullies our reputation in that international community. But far more important, if we were to raise the money which 0.7% of gross national product would yield internationally, then we would raise close to $200 billion a year, which would meet AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, the other dreadful diseases. It would meet water, education, health infrastructure, health capacity, nutrition, agriculture, the entire infrastructure of struggling countries. And instead, we're at somewhere between $60 and $70 billion a year internationally, with calamitous effects on the economies concerned. Number two is the question of conflict. And all of this is quite naturally heartbreaking. I saw a poster in the corridor as I approached the podium indicating that General Romeo Dallaire will be here on March 12th next, and I thought to myself, how extraordinarily fortunate for all of you, because this is the man who comes more closely to the profile of a saint in Canada than any other person I know. And what Romeo experienced in Rwanda is a pattern which has not yet ended. In 100 days, between April 6, 1994 and early July, 800,000 people were slaughtered in the full light of the world, and the world raised not a finger. And yet we said, never again. And what appears to be happening is that never again has transmogrified into again and again and again. So if I keep my eyes on the continent of Africa, never forgetting, however, Cambodia and East Timor and the Balkans and Colombia, and recognizing that these acts of episodic depravity occur on all continents, but for the moment seem to be concentrated in Africa, let me remind you that at this very day, there is in northern Uganda a lunatic religious sect called the Lord's Resistance Army, which has regularly been abducting young children, usually in their early teenage years, from their homes and the boarding schools of the northern part of Uganda, taking them across into the Sudan, turning the girls into sex slaves, the boys into child soldiers, and subjecting those kids to atrocities that are beyond the capacity of the mind to comprehend. There have been over 20,000 kids abducted in the last 12 to 15 years. A third of them are dead. A third of them are probably lost forever in the Sudan. A third of them returned back to northern Uganda. I've interviewed I don't know how many of these youngsters in the reception centers of northern Uganda. And their entire childhood is lost. Their little psyches are so damaged by their experience of having to kill members of their own family and seeing atrocities which no child in a lifetime should ever witness, that you wonder how they will ever again function. And so desperate is the situation in northern Uganda, about which the entire international community at the United Nations is informed. Everyone knows. So desperate is the situation that 1,600,000 people are living in displaced persons camps, almost as many as are in the camps of Darfur. And so frightened are they in the camps, even though they've left their homes and their villages to find some kind of security, so frightened are they in the camps that there is a bizarre, almost Kafkaesque phenomenon taking place. where every night at dusk, the parents send their children to the central towns of Gulu and Kitgum, where they stay in centers to provide them safety. One of those centers is called Noah's Ark, which I know well because I was there one night as the children arrived. And you have this incredible apparition of little 6, 7, 8, and 9-year-old kids marching kilometers down the road at twilight, entering the sanctum of the reception center. Indeed, it has become such a pattern that they have a name. They're called the night commuters. And then there's the question of Darfur. It's been going on for 3 years. It's been branded a genocide by all kinds of countries in the world. Everyone understands that what the Janjaweed is doing in conjunction with the government of Sudan is slaughtering and raping people with impunity, and the world has yet to rally. It was just this week, after 200,000 lives are lost and millions of lives uprooted, that the Security Council of the United Nations agreed that it would send a United Nations establishment which might be in place 6 months to a year from now. It is as though the world has lost its moorings. It's as though the world has not understood that you can't stand by after Rwanda, after the slaughter in Srebrenica in the Balkans, and let it all happen again in Darfur. No wonder Romeo Dallaire is at his wit's end about these situations. And what is happening in Darfur is beyond the pale, just as, if I may bring together the offensive symmetrical whole of conflict, what's happening in the Eastern Congo, where the levels of sexual violence and murder have reached an apex of crimes against humanity, the like of which has very few parallels anywhere now in the modern world, particularly the levels of sexual violence. Now, I want to make the point that the world knows that this is happening in northern Uganda, and we all know it's happening in Darfur, and increasingly people understand what is happening in the Eastern Congo, which is a residue of the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, and the world seems absolutely paralyzed to intervene. Back in what was called the General Assembly, and again, the Millennium General Assembly of September 15th to 17th last, Canada received many plaudits and indeed engaged in an orgy of self-promotion when it managed to get agreement internationally on what we called a new principle of the responsibility to protect, and reduced to its elemental essentials. The responsibility to protect simply suggested that if there were crimes against humanity occurring within a country, gross human rights violations within a country, that country could not intervene to protect its citizens, then the world community had an obligation and an opportunity to respond, the responsibility to protect. Whether that would be through economic sanctions or some kind of military intervention is not immediately apparent, but at least it was a principle which afforded a new type of intervention. And from the middle of September to what will be the middle of February, we've heard nary a word about the world acting on the responsibility to protect. It's as though it never happened. And in fact, it was so watered down that it left to the permanent members of the Security Council the right to exercise a veto, which renders the responsibility to protect ultimately impotent. And it's pretty obvious that you can't reach the Millennium Development Goals when countries are so submerged in a deranged and fratricidal series of conflicts. And that leads me to the third point I want to make, which I have made so often across this country that I feel almost self-conscious about it at this point. But it is absolutely evident to everyone that the pandemic of HIV and AIDS in one country after another, in southern and eastern and central, and now creeping into West Africa, is turning back all of the social and economic indices which we assumed would improve life in those countries. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about South Africa or Mozambique or Botswana or Namibia or Lesotho or Swaziland or Zambia or Malawi or Zimbabwe, or Rwanda, or Kenya, or Tanzania, or Uganda, no matter which of those countries you're talking about, ranging right up to Ethiopia, and over on the west coast to Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria, and Cameroon. In all of these countries, there are elements of the society struggling for survival, and there are some countries themselves as a whole, organic whole, struggling for survival. If you were born in Zambia today, your life expectancy is 30 years. In most of the Western world, life expectancy is approximating 80 years. In most of the countries of Southern Africa, life expectancy now varies somewhere between 38 and 45 years of age. It would have been well up into the 60s if it weren't for the pandemic. And I simply want to say that I'm apprehensive every time I go back. It may be that the cumulative impact of 4 to 5 years of seeing people die gets to you at a point which renders you, if not paralyzed, at least ineffective. I'm leaving for Africa again later this afternoon, and I'm going to Lesotho and Swaziland and Mozambique, and I'm anxious as I leave, knowing what I'm going to confront. Because in all those countries, the pervasiveness of death is overwhelming. We hear, and I'll allude to it momentarily, of the glimpses of hope that are emerging, and they're palpable, and they're real. But the people who were infected in the late 1980s and early 1990s are dying now, and they are dying in hallucinatory numbers. And now the hospital wards are filled with AIDS-related patients. And every day sees a plethora of funerals in every single country, and children are haunted by the reality of death to which their parents and relatives and extended family are subject. And the overwhelming struggle for survival, where you hear the president of Botswana using the word extermination to describe what he feels his country has confronted, and when you hear the prime minister of Lesotho using the word annihilation when he describes what he feels his country is confronting. And I sat down with the president of Zambia in his cabinet just a few months ago, and he said, "Mr. Lewis, it's a holocaust in this country." And I was reading the Hansard from Namibia, where the deputy prime minister, the former minister of health, a wonderful woman named Libertina, said, and I quote her exactly, "Mr. Speaker, my country is on its knees." It's necessary to understand that the grip that the virus has on these countries, the heroic resistance, the resilience, the enormous camaraderie and decency and generosity and sophistication at the grassroots, particularly amongst the women. But it's very hard to withstand the assault of the virus. And in a fashion which is positively Darwinian in its selection, it is, of course, as again I've said frequently, because with me it is the single most horrendous dimension of the pandemic. It's what is happening to the women of Africa, to the women in their youngest years, to the women between the ages of 15 and 24, where the percentage of those infected rises to 75 to 76% of the total. And the affront to common sense, the affront to the human spirit, the reality of gender inequality doing such damage to women, the absolute inability to exercise sexual autonomy and sexual independence, the way in which the virus, not just in Africa but beyond, is driven by predatory male sexual behavior, the fact that women in marriage are more vulnerable than women in the surrounding community of individual sexually active women, the way in which older men marry younger women, the younger women think they're in a monogamous relationship, the older men with multiple sexual encounters bring the virus into the marriage. God, it's hallucinatory. These women, they do all the work in Africa. It's one of the things that makes the continent so immensely appealing. The women are so remarkably forceful and commanding and devoted. They do all the caring for the people who are sick. They look after themselves. They look after the orphans. They do all the farming. They carry the water. They do all the cooking. They go to market. They sustain the society. And they are dying in horrendous numbers. I've had the bizarre experience of visiting rural villages where you look at the people around you and you have this unsettling, almost surreal experience of seeing that amongst the women, they're either very young or very old, and there's no one in between. I think it's important to say, because I'm speaking in a university environment, that if ever anyone questioned the feminist analysis, I beg you to discard the questions. Because the feminist analysis of male power and authority and the resistance of men to relinquish power and authority is possibly the most insightful analysis that can possibly be provided to gain a sense of what is happening in many of these countries. And the struggle for gender equality is the single most important struggle there is on the face of the earth, and it's tougher. It's tougher even than racial equality. But the struggle for gender equality will mean the emancipation of millions upon millions of women. And people say to me, Stephen, what about the men? Can't you teach the prevention? Can't you change their behavior? And the answer is everybody is working at it, but it'll take three generations to change male sexual behavior, and the women are dying now. So there's a terribly important ethos at work to empower women right away, to give to them the legislative and related apparatus, property rights, inheritance rights, rights against sexual violence, all of the panoply of things we take for granted in order to save the women of Africa. And of course, if you're losing such numbers, you're losing your human capacity, you're losing your nurses and your doctors and your teachers and your farmers and your civil servants and your community health workers. My God, this little country of Malawi, 12 million people, it has 94 doctors. It has a total of 2 pediatricians in the entire country. I'm going to Swaziland for a graduating class of their nursing school as part of the trip. The last graduating class in Swaziland graduated 100 nurses. 57 of them left the country within a month for better jobs, and the other 43 experienced the terrible toll of AIDS. The loss of capacity is everywhere evident and needs replenishment. And then to top absolutely everything off, there are the orphans in the millions. Next week in London, there's a meeting of what is called the Global Partners Forum of 80 or 90 international agencies coming together to try to figure out what in heaven's name do you do with these millions of orphan children wandering the landscape of Africa, so completely bereft, so bewildered, so frantic, so desperate for nurture and love. Little kids who've watched their parents die and then shunted from communities who cannot put them up because they're too impoverished. Or grandmothers who are the heroes of the continent and look after 5, 10, 15, or 20 children. The grandmothers who bury their own adult children and then look after their orphan grandchildren. And when the grandmothers die because there's no one coming up behind, you have child-headed households where little kids as young as 8, 9, or 10 become parents to their siblings of 3, 4, and 5. It just ruptures the entire dynamic of the human constellation as we understand it. And it requires a tremendously urgent intervention. And those interventions are coming, but so incrementally that it breaks one's heart. There is stepped up treatment. And treatment is beginning to turn the tide and give people hope. Because if they can be treated and have their lives prolonged, then they know that if they're tested and they're found to be HIV positive, it's not a death warrant. They can turn to the drugs and have their lives extended. And then there are drugs. There are now antiretroviral drugs. We call them fixed-dose combinations. They come from India. They are generic drugs. 3 drugs in 1 tablet taken twice a day. The regimen is very easy to follow. The side effects are extraordinarily nominal. And the adherence rates are higher in Africa than they are in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. And now the prices have been reduced to a point where it's possible to treat almost everyone in a country for free if the Western world will deliver on the dollars which have been committed. The drugs used to cost $10,000 to $12,000 per person per year from the brand name pharmaceutical companies. The brand name pharmaceutical companies who were revealed as treasuring their balance sheets more than they did human life have been reducing the amount over the years so that it is now down to something like $600 to $900 per person per year. But that's way beyond the capacity of people who live on less than a dollar a day. So suddenly along came the Bill Clinton Foundation Initiative. And they went off to India, and they negotiated with two major Indian generic drug companies, and incredibly enough, they reduced the price to $139 per person per year. It was damn near miraculous. And then they did something else equally splendid and exemplary. They managed to persuade the Indian generic companies to produce pediatric compounds, drugs which could treat children, which we have never had before now. And there is a terrific movement on what is called the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, where the use of a wonder drug called nevirapine, administered to the mother during the birthing process, the liquid equivalent given to the infant within 48 hours of birth, and you can reduce the transmission of the virus by up to 53% and save hundreds of thousands, millions of children's lives. And now we're beginning to treat the mothers who are HIV positive and keep them alive as well, and the families. And UNICEF, back in November, said that it would seek to raise $1 billion over 6 years to respond to the needs of 10 million orphans. And there is a tremendous concentration on the scientific quest for a vaccine, probably 10 years off, alas, and a microbicide, a cream or a gel or a foam which a woman can apply to herself with the partner not even knowing, and it will prevent the transmission of the virus. And that appears to be something like 4 to 7 years maximum away, and we will save millions of women's lives. In other words, there are all the elements in place to subdue this pandemic if the G8 countries will deliver on the financial contributions that were promised in that orgy of triumphalism at the G8 summit last July, when Bob Geldof went berserk, which I judge is his regular state of mind, and said that never had the world seen such a remarkable achievement. And if we provide the dollars and some of the technical assistance and refurbish the human capacity, then a continent will survive. What kind of world is it that simply dispenses with hundreds of millions of people? But I have to report, painful though it is, predictable though it is, that the promises of Gleneagles are already shredding. The promises that were made at Gleneagles in July began to fall apart at what was called the first major test of those promises, at a replenishment conference for the Global Fund on AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, where they fell several billion dollars short of the target they required for 2006-2007, which everyone assumed they would achieve because of the momentum from Gleneagles, and which, alas, will be counted in the millions of lives. I've often felt, in this tremendous, spirited, urgent tussle between self-interest on the one hand and human decency on the other, which animates the international community, I've always felt that the universities have a tremendous role to play, because this is the intellectual center of a society. This is where the clamor of ideas are shaped and confronted and confounded and engaged. And if not a university community, where? I hold certain ideological briefs. I wouldn't pretend otherwise for a moment. But those briefs are subject to criticism and analysis and change, and all of that can occur when university students and faculty and the community as a whole comes to grips with these issues. And universities can do research. They can make contributions. You know, the University of Toronto Law School approached me just a couple of years ago and said they'd like to help with the envoy work that I was doing internationally, and they would set up a course and they would give it 3 or 4 credits and it would last a full semester, and would my little group of colleagues and I present to them a series of research subjects which their students who were interested would pursue. And we gave them 20 or 25 research subjects to 20 or 25 students, ranging from intellectual property rights and the World Trade Organization on one hand, right through to questions of sexual violence and the way countries were coping with it on the other. And the papers that were produced are astonishing. And I'm about to start to use them in my own advocacy. And indeed, we met just 10 days ago with the new set of students for the next semester, where they're going to pursue a different set of research subjects. And I thought to myself, this is the essence of a university. This is where the research is applied and improves the human condition. And then people say to me, what can I do on a personal basis? How can I get involved? It's an intolerable human predicament. I want to respond. Because everybody agrees that there is a renaissance of response in Canada, particularly amongst young people, and if I may say, particularly amongst young women in their 20s and early 30s. I see them in conflict zones, refugee camps, internally displaced camps, vulnerable communities. It's quite astonishing. And there are wonderful non-governmental organizations, CARE, Save the Children, Doctors Without Borders, World Vision, Plan International, UNICEF through the UN system. They do remarkable things on the ground. You can attach yourself to them for a time. It isn't merely a matter of raising money. It can be policy discussions. It can be actually going to the country and for a period of time making a personal and individual contribution. There is nothing more exhilarating in life. Your life will never be the same again. And I cannot tell you how deeply and profoundly it is appreciated. And there are always, as you know, reverberations between the global and the local. There are always, as in Vancouver, a downtown east side and injecting drug use and poverty, which has spawned significant prevalence rates of HIV. There are, in this province and in this country, Aboriginal communities living lives of despair as the community of Canada and the government of Canada fail adequately to respond. And while there is, thankfully, no conflict in this country, there are fascinating locuses of conflict studies, as here at UBC, where people are wrestling with peacekeeping and peacemaking and their application. There is so much that is locally stitched to what is globally real. And I'm one of those people who believes, I don't mean to be maudlin or romantic about it, that there are such things as global citizens, that there are people who care about the world. I know that when I'm in Swaziland at some point, a week to 10 days from now, a group of women is going to come up to me and they're going to say, Mr. Lewis, they will have their children in tow. What will happen to my children when I die? And they'll all be in their 20s. And I will not know what to say. And they will add, Mr. Lewis, or more accurately, you, Mr. White Man, you have drugs in your country to keep your people alive. Why can't we have drugs to keep ourselves alive? And I won't be able to answer that either. I know only that the year 2005 was the first year when the world spent more than $1 trillion on armaments since the end of the Cold War. And I know only that something in the vicinity of $500 to $600 billion will be spent on wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by the end of this year. And we cannot find a microscopic smidgen to address the human condition. What in God's name has gone wrong with this world? And if you will forgive an ancient and avuncular guy gently inching into his dotage, you, this generation, you, the students here assembled, this is where the change comes from. This is where it is generated. We're all members of a remarkably good country, a country that has enormous standing in the world, whether or not we really deserve it. We're a country that belongs to the Commonwealth and the Francophonie and the G8. We're the only country that belongs to all three. And people regard us with immeasurable respect, and we have carved out an enormous repute. And we can make a difference. There is always room for a principled, uncompromising voice which doesn't pretend to moral perfection, but says there are certain moral benchmarks in a world. You don't write off millions of people. And when one part of the human family is under siege, the privileged part of the human family responds. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Woo. I do have goosebumps. Kelowna, can you see that? We have about half an hour for questions. We have two mics on the floor on either side here, and we also will be taking questions from Kelowna. So please, I invite any of you and all of you to come down to ask a question. Because the timing is a little bit tight, if you don't get a chance to ask a question, I will also note that right after the Q&A period, Mr. Lewis will be in the lobby to sign books for about an hour or so. So there's also an opportunity there to interact. Other than that, I guess we can start with some questions.
Please, thank you for starting things off.
Thank you for coming and witnessing through your life and through your actions and through your words. I've been sort of keeping tabs as best as I can on the situation in Africa. And I have written letters to the Prime Minister and to my local MPs, urging them to commit to the 0.7%. And you always get these responses back, these like, well, we're so great, we've had these commitments. And so I've always been a little unclear, particularly with these initiatives like Make Poverty History, which are really emphasizing the 0.7%. When a country makes that commitment, who do they make that financial commitment to? Like, where does the money go? Does it go to the UN? Is it up to the government at the time to divvy up the money to organizations as they see fit? Or is it specifically going to, say, the UN or some really intelligent and, like, big-hearted NGOs who know what they're doing on the ground? That's my question.
Thank you. No, it's an awfully good question, and one that has not been asked of me before, and I much appreciate it. And please don't give up on writing to your members of Parliament and to the new Prime Minister, and keep the pressure on. I would suggest that all of you write to David Emerson as quickly as possible. Well, you can write twice. You can write to him as an elected conservative. You can write to him as a converted liberal. You can write to him as elected liberal and then a converted conservative. The guy clearly has problems of identity, and if no problems of ambition and opportunism. I would think that the business of keeping the pressure on is really worthwhile. And what happens when you've reached the 0.7, or you commit yourself to the 0.7, is that the government in power designates the distribution of the funds. You can give a portion of it directly to foreign aid for countries, a portion of it to United Nations agencies, a portion of it to non-governmental organizations, a portion of it sometimes stays in Canada to alert the Canadian public to the priorities of international humanitarian development. Most of that money goes to the Canadian International Development Agency, CEDA, and CEDA decides then on how the money is apportioned. In the case of AIDS, Canada has done quite well. They've given money to the World Health Organization to put people into treatment, to the Global Fund on AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, although nowhere near enough. to the scientific inquiry on a vaccine, the same with the microbicide. And we are one of the very, very few countries, at the moment the only country in the Western world, which actually is manufacturing generic drugs for export to developing countries to treat HIV and AIDS. We're taking advantage of a loophole in the World Trade Organization's intellectual property rights provision, and that is to Canada's credit. What we haven't done, which is why the question was so valuable, is commit to the 0.7% on a timetable which would allow us to deliver on the commitment. Yes.
Hello. Thank you very much. It's really wonderful hearing you speak. I just wanted to ask, I've recently returned from Uganda where I did a medical elective, which was fantastic. And while I was there, I overheard on the BBC short radio waves that the Blair government had withdrawn $40 million, I believe, in international funding for that country because of corruption. And just being there and noticing or seeing one particular case where a young woman died of a state of shock because of AIDS-related disease, and because there was no resuscitation fluid in the hospital, because of the corruption, it had been sold off in the market, and then driving into the larger cities and seeing the large houses of the bureaucrats. And I mean, I can understand that, and Canada, we're falling short of our goals, your goals, I suppose, in some ways, our goals, and also that there, too, there's much corruption, and I just wanted to hear your comments on the role of corruption in Africa.
Let me try to, that was asked of me at the Center for International Affairs this morning as well, but let me try to adduce from you something which speaks to the other side of the equation. I assume that in your work in a medical elective, where were you working?
Mbarara University Hospital.
Right. That in your work you also saw significant numbers of Ugandan doctors, nurses, and others devoting themselves pretty heavily.
It's unbelievable. They get paid nothing and they work so hard.
And they throw
their hands up at the corruption and they say, what can I do?
But that's the balance that has to be maintained, is that we're not throwing money away. There is a tremendous amount going on, more in Uganda than most countries, because of the involvement of the American Presidential Initiative money as well as the money from the Global Fund. By the way, Tony Blair did not freeze the $40 million because of corruption. He froze it because the British, are concerned that Museveni is going to seek a third term, and they're offended by what appears to be a violation of democratic practice. The Global Fund on AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria suspended its payments to Uganda. It was payments of potentially $225 million because they were concerned with the way in which the money was being handled. Now, that's an interesting example. They went in. Everybody, the government of Uganda and the Global Fund, hired an independent group of financial people to appraise what had gone wrong, to put the systems in place. They put the systems in place, they protected the systems, and they released the $225 million literally 2 or 3 months later. So there is in this world a very considerable effort to root out evidences of corruption, both within governments and induced from outside favors. And while there are many examples, I don't doubt, they are, I think, gradually being whittled down. You're right. Sometimes they cost human life. In Canada, the word gomery is in my mind, but I know this. You want to go for it?
Yeah. Hello, is there a question from Kelowna?
Yes. Are you able to hear me clearly from here?
Yes, we can. It's a little sepulchral. It makes me nervous. But it's a disembodied voice, but we can hear you.
All right. Thank you very much for taking my question. My question is related to the media. And I would like to ask you, do you think that the Western media has profoundly failed in informing the public of the state of the third world, reducing stories to nothing more than 30-second, once-a-week spots, and further making no attempt at informing the public the promises made and not kept, despite being such tiny commitments for the most powerful countries in the world?
Thank you. I've never been one who feels that the media fails in that sense. I think we tend to get the coverage of international events that we deserve. There is, when you have a tsunami, for example, coverage which is quite overwhelming, understandable in the context of such an energizingly destructive moment. In the case of international development, I think television has been less assiduous than it might be. I think that print journalism has been pretty good on international development issues. In this country, the Globe and Mail has probably just about the best practicing journalist in all of Africa, Stephanie Nolan. And Stephanie Nolan gets tremendous space in the Globe and Mail, and she writes more eloquently and knowledgeably about third world problems than anywhere except perhaps the New York Times and the Washington Post. And they have very good people as well. I understand your question, but I think that it's television which tends to reduce everything to momentary sound bites, but that print remains, and this is a nice thing about the internet, print remains the main vehicle for most people on these issues, and the print journalists do us reasonably well. Anyone else? Yes, this microphone down here.
Yeah, just on the media, I guess one problem is that a lot of the corporate interests that are doing so much damage in places like Sudan and Africa are the same people who own the media here, own a big portion of the media. And I think about the example of Sudan, where when 5 years ago Talisman Oil in Alberta was still in Sudan and doing great damage to fuel the civil war there, we heard nothing essentially about Sudan, and now finally that's starting to change. I wanted to ask you a little bit, though, about Haiti, where one noted Canadian journalist, your daughter-in-law, Naomi Klein, has been one of the many Canadian independent journalists uncovering the role of the Canadian government in overthrowing Haiti's democracy. And I mentioned Haiti. I think it's relevant today because if there's a version of Africa's misery or an approximation in the Western Hemisphere, it's Haiti with the legacy of slavery and colonialism. And it's really unbelievable when you look into the facts and realize that the Canadian government helped to overthrow a democracy there in Haiti. And I'd be interested in your views on that, and just more generally how, and I should just say this was done in the name, by invoking the responsibility to protect. So how do we deal with humanitarian interventions, advocating the good ones and the really humanitarian ones, in a world where the people in power are using humanitarian interventions, sometimes retroactively like in Iraq, to justify their own sort of resource grabs and those sorts of things?
Let me take you back to the first part of your question, which is an excellent example, I think, to the audience. The reason that Talisman left Sudan was because of the public clamor in Canada. I mean, Talisman got out of the Sudan because the non-governmental organizations in Canada made life absolutely miserable for Talisman. And there was a lot of coverage. And Talisman's share prices were hurting. And they sold and got out. And I think the argument that Talisman was helping the Sudanese to repress their southern populations, that really struck home. And that is a remarkable example of where the voices of a collective public raised in outrage can make a definite policy shift. And I think that's how we got rid of Talisman. I felt very close to that struggle, and I watched it carefully. Around Haiti, I completely agree with your analysis. By the way, it well preceded the responsibility to protect. Aristide is gone now for quite a while. Responsibility to protect in a formal way didn't come in until September 2005. And Canada's role, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It is startling that we would be so collaborative with the United States foreign policy that we would perform as an adjunct. Now, we'll have to see what happens in the elections and whether the person who is likely to be made president and who claims a certain friendship and affinity with Aristide, who might or might not be then allowed to return with all of the implications. I don't know how that's going to play itself out, but if you're asking me, has Canada's involvement in Haiti been ignoble? Yes, you're completely right. And again, it requires, I think, a strong degree of citizen outrage, which has not been reflected in that struggle.
Theory and practice, focusing on the degree of real-world awareness in the most powerful offices and the effectiveness of UN policies in enacting real positive change.
Look, That's an awfully good question, and I appreciate it because it allows me to say something I would like to say.
That was the point.
They all know. Everybody knows. No one is ignorant of what is happening, either in the impoverished areas of developing countries or in the conflict zones. It reminds me when Bill Clinton, a man I greatly admire and think is probably the finest communicator on the face of the planet, when Bill Clinton said that the reason they hadn't intervened in Rwanda was because he didn't know. I don't believe a word of it. And I spent 2 years studying the genocide in Rwanda as part of a panel which was struck for that precise purpose. Everybody knew. The reports were coming back from the diplomats in the country on every single front. There wasn't a thing that the Americans and the French and the Belgians didn't know. They knew every aspect. Just ask Romeo Dallaire when he's here. The delinquency comes from an absence of concern and an absence sometimes of political will. But mostly it seems to me to be concern. The Security Council members know everything. Their intelligence pours in from every single area. Now, sometimes the intelligence, as we learned about Iraq, can be wildly manipulated and askew. But that's just because there are certain aberrations in the American intelligence system so stark that it warps the information. But the information pours in from anywhere, everywhere. All you have to do is stop and appraise it. And that's true of all of us, every country. Has these diplomatic missions and contacts everywhere which give it the information. So the problem is in the political will, is in the political concern. You know, Bush travels in Africa, Blair travels in Africa, Gordon Brown goes to Africa, Paul Martin goes to Africa, Chirac goes to Africa. They travel with Bono, they travel with Jeffrey Sachs, they meet Mandela, they shake hands with Tutu, they go out to the slums of Nairobi, they see Darfur. And then they come back, and it's as if it doesn't make an impact. But they understand. They know what's happening. They just choose not to respond. And that is a gap between theory and practice, which doesn't emanate from a lack of understanding. It emanates from a lack of principle. You want to go to Okanagan?
Question from Kelowna.
Yes, it's the disembodied voice again. But about your comment about Romeo Dallaire, I have read his book, Shake Hands with the Devil, and highly recommend it. And if there's one thing that I could do in my life, I would like to meet him in person. I think he's definitely the Canadian hero. But my question to you is, do you think that a lot of the lack of political will coming from Western countries could be leftovers from the incident in Somalia with the Black Hawk and the loss of the American soldiers being dragged through the street, and now Africa seems to be almost a political pariah for Western leaders, and they just, even though they can come in and fix it, they simply do not want to for political reasons.
Well, I think that what happened in Somalia in August of 1993 certainly freaked out the American public and the American president, but it wasn't really the explanation for Rwanda, and it isn't really the explanation for what's happened since. I mean, they did lose 18 Rangers on the streets of Mogadishu in an act which was pretty depraved when they were dragged through the streets and stoned and disemboweled and treated so brutally. On the other hand, the Americans have already lost 2,000 combatants in Iraq. God knows how many thousand more have been wounded. It doesn't seem to still their ardor for the continuing conflict. I think, as with everything else, it's a matter of self-interest at any given moment in time, and it's a matter of whether or not it fits the geopolitics of one of the major Western powers. Iraq does. Other parts of Africa don't. I don't think it was Somalia. I think it was a general abandonment of the continent. Yes, one more over here.
Thank you. I'm part of a student organization at UBC called the Sustainability Pledge. And one of the things that I have seen is this perceived isolation between issues of social sustainability and issues of ecological sustainability. And to me, those two concepts are so intertwined. And I think we can see all over the world that there are major inequalities in terms of resource distribution and resource use. And I mean, most of us are going to go home today and use however many liters of water it is, 300 or so liters of water that each of us uses per day. Whereas I'm sure you've observed in countries in Africa, there's less than a liter of water per day, or sometimes none. And so what I'm interested in is your observances on those, the intersections of different kinds of justice and the ways that perhaps the way that we consume in this society is perpetuating the types of ecological poverty that you've witnessed.
Good question. And you clearly understand the issues extremely well. I just came back from Monrovia in Liberia, where I was present at the inauguration of the first woman president in Africa, which was a thrilling thing. But I mention it because there's no water at all in Monrovia. None. There are occasional water tankers that enter the town and sell water at really exorbitant prices that people cannot afford, but there is no water. Similarly, there is no electricity, except if you happen to have a private generator at a hospital or a hotel or a diplomatic mission. And the ways in which these ecological violations have had impacts on developing countries are very strongly etched. As a matter of fact, you make a very good point, because I shouldn't be making speeches when I think of it, outlining the Millennium Development Goals, which exclude the goal of environmental sustainability, since it's so strongly linked with all of the other areas of sustainability life. So I thank you for that, and I'll correct it in the future. And I got a big kick out of the fact when I read the Globe and Mail this morning that David Suzuki has been moved from a member of the Order of Canada to a companion of the Order of Canada in recognition of the way in which he has done exactly what you've said, stitched together the environmental imperatives with the social imperatives. The way in which we use and abuse resources in the developing world absolutely accentuates their poverty. The way in which we never have enough water in the developing world is an increasing cause of conflict, which is going to cost the world great, great problems. Those of you who haven't read Maud Barlow's most recent book, I urge you to do so, Maud Barlow, the Council of Canadians, because although she's talked about the integration of Canadian and American economies, she also raises these other issues, which she's done all her life. The fact that we are dealing with such abandon with climate change and the consequences of global warming and the continued reliance on fossil fuels. I was quite taken aback when George Bush mentioned solar and wind energy. I mean, he must have had a visitation of some kind, because I don't understand how it otherwise occurred. But the truth is that all of us know that the argument around the dependence on fossil fuels has been unanswerable for the last 10 years. And yet we've developed almost no alternative renewable energy sources worthy of the name. All of these ecologically interdependent things, which have impacts on human health and in the apportionment of resources in a country, they need to be linked together. And you're right to do that. And I wish you well in the campus undertaking. Yes.
Hi there. I'm a SFU student, so I'm unsure of the UBC formalities here. But I'd just like to say thank you for coming, and I love listening to what you have said. I was fortunate enough to listen to Romeo Dallaire talk at a breakfast here as well. And I think with the human touch and human compassion and with people like you, we'll definitely try to bring about change in this world. And when you get asked the question, what will happen when you die, say, hopefully the next global citizen will step up to the challenge. And I really regretted not asking Romeo this question when he was here is, can I give you a great big Canadian bear hug? I just feel like you've been through a lot and through a lot of... You've seen a lot, and I feel this human touch, and you just need a great big Canadian... I just want to give you a hug, that's it.
I have been through a lot, And I noticed that no UBC student offered to hug me, which I...
It's all right.
Well, I'll come down in a moment. Do you mind?
Okay.
We'll do it. No, no, I will make a special point so the photographers can gather and so that that's very nice of you. And it's also nice of you not to ask me what will happen when I die, because it's not a question to which I give an instantaneous reply. I sometimes think there are certain romantic spasms to which one is given, but I genuinely believe, I was listening to a colleague in the arts class, Michael Byers, I guess, this morning, Professor Michael Byers, this morning when we met with the students from the Center for International Studies, and I was listening to him say to the students who were there, but with enormous urgency and force, you can make a difference. There's enough power in this room to start social change in Canada, to begin to build a movement, to keep the pressure on in a way which will shift things. And I thought to myself as I was listening to him, he couldn't be more right. You should never individually or collectively underestimate the force of a passionate cause principally pursued. But it requires principle. It requires being uncompromising. You can't shift your ground. You have to keep your eye focused on what the human need is and don't allow yourself to be distracted or diverted or pushed into a detour. And there is tremendous power in advocacy. God, advocacy is a magnificent tool. And never diminish it. Use it at every turn. Letters to the editor. All candidates' meetings during election time, phone calls to political appointees, associations with the Make Poverty History campaign, demonstrations, every single artifact there is, it all builds, it all means something, it changes public policy. Don't be dissuaded or diminished or concerned, it changes public policy. You just have to keep at it. Be so tenacious, be so indefatigable that every time they see you coming, they say, in effect, leave us alone, we'll do it. It's the way I learned to canvass for the NDP. And I lived a life of transcendental political futility. So I can only encourage all of you, don't let them get you down, just keep at it. Now, if we go to Kelowna again, I once managed a campaign, I want you to know, in Salmon Arm in 1956 when the campaign issue was anatomical drawings in health textbooks. The then CCF, precursor of the NDP, wanted the genitalia to be vivid and real, a sort of modernism in artistic expression. The then Social Credit Party wanted the genitalia to be amorphous and only vaguely delineated, the sort of expressionism in modern art. I think it's worth noting that Social Credit won. In any event, so when I hear about Kelowna, my mind goes back to the Okanagan. But if the Kelowna disembodied voice wants to haunt us yet again, it's yours.
A different disembodied voice.
Excellent.
Just going back to your response a few minutes ago about Western leaders going to Africa and seeing all the horror there and then coming back and doing nothing. We can certainly blame them for that, but aren't we as Canadian citizens also to blame somewhat in that if those political leaders thought that it was a big issue with us as Canadians, they would do something about it. The reason why they don't is because they don't believe that most of us as Canadians do care enough about it.
Actually, it's a very good point. I remember as a history student reading textbooks which said that the only time foreign policy ever counted in an election campaign was Gladstone's campaign in 1885 when he campaigned on Bulgaria. And I have often thought, what in God's name does it take to allow international issues to be part of the political dialogue? Did you notice in this last campaign that there was absolutely no discussion of international affairs at all? It didn't come up in the debates. and it didn't come up from the leaders during the course of the campaign itself. It was as though Canada exists in some kind of vacuum, and there is nothing out there to which we are hinged. It was most, most unusual. So the gentleman makes an awfully good point, that if there is a sense of an aroused public around these issues, then political leadership will respond. And please, please remember, this is a minority government. I sat for more than 15 years in a parliament. Politicians are never more susceptible to influence and pressure than a minority situation. Their antennae are electric with anxiety. And the approach, the overtures, the arguments are given very real hearing. And I would urge you to make it known to the political leadership of Canada that this generation cares, and cares deeply, and expects from its politicians a similar quality of caring. And with that somewhat tangentious observation, I thank you again.